Our second case this morning is United States against Harcrow. Counsel for the defense.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Major Brian Jackson, and I represent the appellant in this case. And the pivotal question here is, under what circumstances may the government admit a scientific laboratory report as a substitute for live testimony at trial in light of Crawford v. Washington? Now, the lower court tells us in answer to this question that the only circumstance that really matters is whether or not that scientific laboratory report was prepared in the regular course of business. The appellant contends that the circumstances surrounding the creation of the report, who requested it, who prepared it, what was its primary purpose, we contend that these circumstances do in fact matter, and we urge this court to adopt a bright-line definition of testimonial statements protected by the Confrontation Clause that requires confrontation of all laboratory reports that are, one, occasioned solely by the arrest of the accused, two, prepared at the behest of law enforcement officials, and three, offered by the government in furtherance of criminal prosecution. In every such case, these laboratory documents look like testimony, sound like testimony, and function at trial
what
as
if,
testimony.
What if the you took that sample and you put it in the batch or the latest batch that was going down for unit sweep, and so the lab technician doesn't get a single bottle or whatever one gets, but 1,000 bottles, and this is just bottle number 248. So that the person who sent it down knows what it was sent down for, and so on. But the person who's doing the testing sees it in another bottle in the factory. I'm just responding to your argument. Yeah, I understand that's not this case.
The appellant's position is, those set of facts aren't involved in this particular case.
No, I was responding to your argument because you're trying to tell us what the law should be or how we should interpret Crawford.
Yes, sir.
And you went beyond the needs of this case.
Yes, sir. Okay, I'm sorry, sir. And that is true.
You don't have to apologize. You're helping us shape the law.
That does go to the primary purpose of the tester in that particular instance. It is the appellant's position that Crawford demands confrontation in that case, but that doesn't apply to these particular facts here as far as our argument.
What's the state of the law on this question, generally? I mean, I'm not just talking about in the military justice system. This is a substantial question nationwide. How would you describe the state of the law on this question?
I would describe the state of the law on this question in flux, and that's primarily, this is my contention, that's primarily based on a misunderstanding of what Crawford says and an assistance
to... Well, no, I'm not asking you what you think the law ought to be. I'm asking you, what is your estimation of the state of the law as present? The Supreme Court hasn't ruled on this particular question. Are the circuits divided?
I believe the circuits are divided.
How about state?
The states are divided, but from my reading, it would appear that most states are coming down the line of finding these laboratory documents under certain circumstances as testimonial.
Okay, it appears you would agree that a reasonable estimate of the present state of the law is it's in flux and unclear.
It is very much in flux.
Okay.
And unclear.
Thank you.
Counsel, can you give me your three criteria for the bright line test again?
My three criteria for the bright line test is when the preparation of a laboratory report is occasioned solely upon the arrest of an accused and prepared at the behest of law enforcement officials and offered by the government in furtherance of criminal prosecution. So our contention in every case, these laboratory documents function as testimony of trial.
In this case, it went to a state police lab.
Exactly, sir. It did. And in this particular case, we know that the appellant was arrested.
But your bright line test does not account for what lab it goes to.
No, sir.
So you would say, even if it went to a generic lab,
yes, sir.
I'm just testing your bright line test. And where are you getting your bright lines from? Is this your consolidation of how you've read the state and federal courts? looking at this issue?
It's exactly that. It's my consolidation of my reading and applying the principles set forth in Crawford to, and as far as how they define testimonial statements and how they operate at trial against a criminal defendant.
Counsel, let me ask you a slightly different question. Does Crawford tell us that a defendant must require confrontation? Put a different way, does Crawford tell us that a defendant may not permit the government to put in evidence that would otherwise be testimonial without objection? So, for example, if the government proffered Article 32 investigation testimony as one example,
yes, ma'am.
And the military judge looked at the defendant and said, you know, defense, do you have any objection? And the defense said, no objection. Would that be a violation of the Constitution or of any other principle of criminal law?
My contention is that in that scenario, issue would be subject to this court's plain error analysis.
But how is it error at all if the defendant has said, not just if he hasn't, it's not even a question if he wasn't asked, he was specifically asked and said, no objection? Because it would seem to me that there are many circumstances in which either the defense or the government might prefer to have a piece of paper in evidence as opposed to a live witness.
Yes, ma'am. It's our contention that we're talking about whether or not the appellant waived his constitutional right to confront witnesses against him. It's our contention that this court or any other court cannot find that waiver unless they can find a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver on the part of the appellant on the record. For example, if at that point the military judge expressly inquired into to the appellant, is it your intention to waive this constitutional right to confront? Or if, say, the prosecution and defense got together and prepared a stipulation wherein the defendant knowingly, intelligently waived his right to confrontation. It's our contention that such a fundamental constitutional right cannot be waived simply through inaction on the part of an overworked public defender, for example.
Is that position supported in case law?
Yes, it is, sir. It actually is.
Maybe you could address that on rebuttal, and I would also like you to address how far that reaches. So, for example, every time that that the defense decides not to require the government to lay a foundation for a piece of evidence or not to require the government to authenticate a particular piece of evidence, would that also require the specific sort of knowing and voluntary waiver that you're talking about?
I think, and I will address that more fully in my rebuttal.
Why not right now?
Because I'm not prepared with the case law, but I will say that there is a distinction between a error of constitutional dimension, a waiver of constitutional dimension, and simply an evidentiary waiver, where you know this court can view how that issue was waived. In this instance, we're talking about a fundamental right under the Constitution, and it's our contention that such a waiver cannot be discerned from the appellate court simply through an action. There needs to be some sort of method or way to identify that particular appellant waived the issue.
Okay, counsel, let's assume for a moment that letting this in was error. No objection. If, as you earlier stated, the state of the law is in flux, how can the error be plain? How can a military judge commit plain error? I'm not talking about error. I'm talking about plain error if the state of the law is in flux. Isn't one of the criteria for plain error that the error be obvious and apparent?
The state of the law is in flux because the cases generated from the Crawford decision are just now bubbling up to the surface like we have here.
And, of course, the judge at this time, this was pre-Crawford. But let's assume under Johnson that we take it as we find it now.
In Thomas, for example, the court said plain parentheses now.
Right. We're taking it as we find it now with Crawford, even though the judge didn't have the benefit of Crawford. My question is, you admit that the law, even today with Crawford, is in flux. how can the error be plain?
I should clarify my admission. It's in flux primarily, again, because these types of cases are bubbling up to the appellate courts, where the appellate courts are wrestling with the change in law from the Roberts analysis and the Crawford analysis to where we're getting to, where we're at a point where abiding by the direction provided by the Supreme Court in Crawford.
Counsel, is this case tried under Roberts?
I believe so, yes, sir.
Did the defense object under Roberts?
No, sir, it did not.
Okay, so they didn't object under Roberts, even though they could have objected on the grounds that it wasn't reliable because there was a potential for this particular examiner to have an animus. So they didn't object under the law that existed at the time. Was it error for the judge to admit this, or to allow this testimony to be admitted under the law in existence at the time the case was tried?
That's a difficult question, sir, because...
Well, it's a difficult question. How do you get to plain error?
It's plain error by virtue of the Supreme Court, I believe it's blocking, that actually allows this court to review this particular decision in light of the Crawford mandate.
Right, well, that's a different question, though. The question I think that the chief judge is asking you is, in light of the fact that the military judge did not have the benefit of Crawford and only had the benefit of the Roberts decision, and in light of the fact that the defendant made no objection, in fact said no objection, how could it have been plain error for the military judge not to somehow refuse to allow the laboratory report based on a case that hadn't been decided yet?
Well, it was plain error for many, many reasons. It was error on the part of the military judge for reasons pertaining to the circumstances surrounding the actual report. This report was prepared by a police laboratory worker. This report was prepared in a manner that provides no information as to how the substances seized were tested, what the amount seized was. There's no indication whatsoever of what this...
But did the state of the law at the time require that? You're talking fact. I think Judge Ryan's question goes to law, and it's a different question from my question, which also goes to law.
The state of the law required that this document was admitted as a business record under 803.6. Okay, and that business record exception states that records of regularly conducted activities may be admitted unless they're prepared under circumstances indicating a lack of trustworthiness. Okay, these documents could very well have been objected to as lacking that necessary trustworthiness.
It could have been objected to. So you didn't even need Crawford. You could have objected to it right then under 803.6 at the time the case was tried. Now, what case stands for the proposition that the military judge is required every time a business record is introduced to quiz the defendant personally to see whether he or she agrees with his counsel's or her counsel's decision to not object?
I can cite no case law that supports that position.
Okay, so in that circumstance, how would the judge have plainly erred at the time by not requiring individual questioning of the appellant in this case?
Again, because of the circumstance surrounding the report was admitted through the testimony of one of the Stafford County Sheriff's officers. No representative from the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Can I rephrase the question, if that's okay? There's two issues here that are lurking about the plain error. One is, does Crawford apply retroactively? In the Thomas case, in the D.C. Circuit, for example, they determined that because there is a change in the constitutional landscape that was caused by Crawford, it was appropriate for them to apply the new constitutional standard retroactively. And they made a point of saying the error is now plain, even though it was not plain at the time.
Yes, sir.
That's one issue. The second issue, okay, that's one thing you have to address, is why should this Crawford rule apply retroactively to this case? That's your question, not mine. I mean, your answer, not my answer.
Yes, sir.
Second, if we're now, and nobody understands what Crawford means, and I'm saying that in a argumentative way, because Kate, as you have indicated, courts have decided every which way, if that's true, how can it be plain now if 10 out of 10 courts have reached a different conclusion on what the law is after Crawford? Okay.
So, as to your first question, why should this court apply Crawford now? We should apply it for the very reason stated in the justice's question, because the state is so unclear, because lower courts such as the Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals took this case.
Oh, that seems counterintuitive. If the law is muddy, therefore we should apply it retroactively.
No, sir. Therefore, this court should use this case as a vehicle to express how the military is going to view the testimony of the nation.
That's a good legal policy argument, but it's not rooted in the plain error doctrine. Right? Clarity is good, can be good depending on who you are, but under the plain error doctrine, in theory, the error has to be plain.
It is plain
and
now.
Obvious and
it is plain,
all those things.
It is plain now, to quote the D.C. Circuit Court. It's plain now in light of the Crawford case. And it's our contention that this case is a perfect vehicle to express to all the lower courts that Roberts is no longer in vogue. We're not going to
What text in Crawford makes it plain now?
What text in Crawford makes it plain now?
Right. Why is it plain now, putting aside the retroactivity issue?
When we apply the functional analysis essentially provided in Crawford, it's difficult to imagine statements more paradigmatically testimonial than this forensic certifications made by this police laboratory worker here. Her name is Ms. Maldini. Ms. Maldini was an employee of the Commonwealth of Virginia, Department of Criminal Justice Service. She was a police lab worker. She not only prepared her reports at the behest of law enforcement officials, she was a law enforcement official. She was clearly, when she prepared those reports, she was clearly engaged in a police law office or law enforcement function. There can be no question or doubt that her primary purpose when making those statements on those affidavits was that she was putting that out there for use in future criminal litigation against the appellant. That's what Crawford stands for. Crawford tells us that no longer will we rely on whether or not the underlying hearsay statements are reliable. Now we will view the Confrontation Clause as a procedural rule that commands confrontation to prohibit the government's use of untested exculpatory testimony. And that's exactly what Ms. Maldini, the police state laboratory worker, did in this case. She provided an expert affidavit that amounted to an affidavit from an expert stating the opinion of the expert. The government was allowed to use that opinion in the form of an affidavit, all the while insulating that opinion from testing through the crucible of cross-examination. These types of cases will continue unless this court makes a stand in cases like this and tells the lower court that no, we're going to look at more than whether or not the underlying statement is reliable. We're going to look at more than whether or not these statements fit one of the firmly rooted exceptions to the hearsay clause. We're going to follow the dictates of Crawford. We're going to require that the government prove its case through live testimony. We're going to require that the government not substitute that live testimony through the use of an expert affidavit.
In terms of live testimony, whose testimony would have been sufficient, in your view, for confrontation clause purposes, basically for the constitutional rule that you're arguing to have been met? Would it have been just Ms. Maldini? Would it have been Ms. Maldini plus whoever else might have touched this certificate of analysis?
In this case, it would be certainly Ms. Maldini. Ms. Maldini and her affidavit, she attested. I tested or examined. We don't know whether or not she did either one. But she said, I tested or examined the substances seized, and I certify that the results listed are correct. So in that particular instance, Ms. Maldini would have been required to face the appellant, tell the fact finder, with the appellant standing there, what she found, and be subjected to testing through cross-examination as to her testing methods, her qualifications, all kinds of things that we weren't able to get into.
Unless, as was suggested earlier, the defense would make the strategic determination, no, I don't want all that live testimony here in court to underscore this lab report. I'd be better off on a piece of paper. So I guess that's what you're going to address in rebuttal is, did the judge err by not engaging in some sort of personal colloquy with the appellant himself?
It's always a difficult proposition for the defense to place any type of obligation or burden on him to insist upon the evidence that the prosecution used to convict his client. It would be inappropriate for this court or any court to insist to their rulings that the defendant has a burden.
No, that's different. There's a difference between requiring the defense to call that person as a witness as opposed to the defense objecting to the piece of paper. That's not the same thing.
Yes, sir. In this particular instance, that piece of paper did no good for the appellant. In this particular instance, these laboratory reports are firmly to establish the substances seized as cocaine and heroin. This was a danger to the appellant, and it resulted in his eventual conviction of those particular charges.
I have another question. In your view, is this certificate of analysis a business record, or is it not a business record?
In our view, this is not a business record.
Why is that?
Primarily because business records are ordinary. Going back to the Crawford decision, Justice Scalia mentioned in passing that business records ordinarily would not be considered testimonial. Clearly, that statement was directed at business records of ordinary business transactions, bank records, shopkeeper records. He wasn't referring to records prepared in anticipation of prosecution. In fact, there's a long line of case law that says that records prepared in anticipation of litigation are inherently untrustworthy or lack the indicia of trustworthiness. And that's what we have here. We have a laboratory worker that created these reports after the appellant was arrested. The report that she made lists the appellant as a suspect. She's a police worker preparing these documents in furtherance of her police duties. Clearly, police records can never be considered business records.
How is it more than a routine and objective cataloging of an unambiguous factual matter?
I'll answer that in the following manner, sir.
Okay.
A police officer...
Yeah, the drugs were there or they weren't.
The police officer arrests somebody, makes out a police report. That is his routine function. No one can ever say that particular police report is a business record. Because his primary purpose, he knows that could potentially be used in future litigation. What we're talking here is routine, functions that go on to ordinary transactions. That's what lends this to being a firmly rooted exception to the hearsay rule. It's trustworthy. The writer, the drafter, had no idea that this would later be used in trial. That's why we can rely on it.
This criteria doesn't go to that. This criterion goes to whether it is a routine cataloging of fact, and that's what this report is.
It is
a, either the drugs are present or they are not.
I do not agree. Do not disagree with that, sir. But I would contend that this is, in fact, it's not a business record.
Counsel, I want to move down the road a little bit. In their brief, the government argued that even if the lab reports were testimonial, that it was harmless error, and they pointed out that there were a number of other issues that were raised that corroborated the admissions of the individual. I'd like you to either respond to that now or in rebuttal.
I will, and if I can continue, I know I see I have 30 seconds on my time, but I'll try to continue.
You can, counsel, you can take the time you need to answer Judge Urban's question.
For this constitutional error to be found harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, the government must convince this court that there's no reasonable likelihood that the erroneously admitted laboratory reports contributed to the verdict. And they can't do that here. These laboratory reports contributed heavily to the prosecution's case. They were used to corroborate the testimony of their two main witnesses, Deputy Jackson and Deputy Hedrick. We must first start with the fact that there's only two remaining charges relating to the heroin and cocaine at issue here. One of the charges, the heroin use, specification 4 of additional charge 2, there's a not guilty finding by the military judge. The other, possession of cocaine, additional charge 2, specification 1, that was dismissed by the lower court. So we're only talking about additional charge 2, specification 2, wrongful possession of heroin, and additional charge 2, specification 3, wrongful use of cocaine. Both of those charges were contested at trial. Let me start with the appellant. We know that the appellant took the stand and vehemently denied admitting to using cocaine that evening that he was arrested. Vehemently denied that he told the police officers that he knew that there was heroin in his house. He denied this. Now, there was a conflict because the two officers, Deputy Jackson and Deputy Hatcher, testified that Deputy Jackson asked the appellant, and the appellant said, yes, I used cocaine earlier that day. Yes, you'll find heroin in this bag. So there was a conflict there. That's one. The second thing, the prosecution's evidence was conflicted in its own self. We know that in regards to the possession of heroin, Deputy Jackson said that the appellant told him, yes, that syringe, you will find heroin in that syringe. Again, the appellant said, I didn't say that.
Counsel, on rebuttal, will you take a look at the list that the government has prepared on page 10 of their brief, where they say that there is additional evidence that corroborates the admission? And on rebuttal, respond to those. We're getting a little bit too far into your time here.
I'm sorry, but we'll concede that there may be additional evidence to corroborate the appellant's confession, admission.
But if there is additional evidence that corroborates it, then why is it not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
It's not harmless because the government needed that evidence to get convictions on these two specifications, 2 and 3 under additional charge 2. Okay. They needed that evidence because there was a conflict. They needed the lab evidence to corroborate the two witnesses. They needed the lab evidence because the two witnesses, their testimony was conflicting in its own self. Deputy Jackson said the appellant told him there was heroin in the syringe. Yet the government's own evidence, the lab report, said there was no heroin found in there. That would tend to support the appellant's version that he said there was no heroin there. The lab reports functioned to corroborate the two deputies' versions of events, to corroborate what they said the appellant told him. And I will address the later further issues.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, I am Major James Wireless on behalf of the United States. There are two issues before this court. One being the failure on appellant's part to object to the introduction of the lab reports at trial. As has been discussed by this court, that will be analyzed under a plain error analysis. Even assuming plain error and that it is of a constitutional dimension, the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The second issue is the issue of the lab reports and whether or not they are testimonial, as that term has been fleshed out by Crawford v. Washington. There are not adequate facts on the record to make that determination. There was not an adequate factual basis for that determination to be made either by the trial judge or the lower court.
So in your view, the lower court went too far in this case?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, if the lower court went too far.
I have a little trouble understanding, even though it's a clear opinion in many respects, but I would say they have trouble reconciling their analysis by the lower court of this issue, where it appears that they are coming to the legal conclusion that there's no error because lab reports are non-testimonial, but they say that they're making a plain error analysis, and then they say in the end that the issue was not plain error and the issue was waived. That would dovetail with what I believe the suggestion that you just made is that we don't have a case before us in which the issue was litigated as to what transpired with respect to this particular evidence, and therefore we don't have a showing on the part of the appellant as to why there was plain error.
I'll try to answer that question as succinctly as I can, Your Honor, but I believe the position is if you look at the lower court's opinion, they do not go through the necessary analysis as set out by this court in United States v. Magyari.
Right.
They make the jump and make the statement that as business records, the lab reports are admissible under a firmly rooted exception, and then cite to Magyari. Clearly, that is right. Not the test to be applied to determine if lab.
Yeah, that answers my question. That is, and so is it the view of the government that this is not the proper case for us to make a flat determination as to whether lab reports are or are not always business records if they meet the, that are exempt from Crawford, if they meet the evidentiary as opposed to constitutional test for what is a business record?
First, Your Honor, the government's position remains the same as in Magyari, that lab reports are inherently non-testimonial because they are business or public records, but recognizing that this court rejected that position, that is correct, that there's not the factual basis to make the determination. Thus, this case should be remanded.
Not a factual basis in this case to determine whether the statement was testimonial under Crawford, is that what you're saying?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why would we need to remand it? This is an issue of law. Why can't we make our own plain error determination here?
I believe specifically because of the holding in Magyari, Your Honor, as this court stated, that the Magyari holding was based upon the facts of that case and went on.
What fact are we missing here?
Well, Your Honor, exactly as this court had asked earlier about what were these documents? What were Prosecution Exhibit 1 and 2? Were they business records? Were they prepared by this laboratory scientist with input from lab technicians? Were they opinions as to this was the scientist's determination of what these substances were? Or, on the other end of the spectrum, they could have been coming completely out of a machine.
Is it your contention that this is Magyari, is not Magyari, or we can't tell?
We cannot tell, Your Honor.
Okay. On the facts.
On the facts as represented in the record.
But again, why do we have to remand to the Court of Criminal Appeals if, and I'm not telegraphing an answer here, if we were to conclude that it was the obligation of the defense to at least put those issues into play at trial, and they didn't do that, and that the state of the law is in flux, why isn't that sufficient to demonstrate no plain error in this case and resolve it on that fashion?
If I may, Your Honor, the government's position is maybe threefold. First, that even assuming plain error...
I'm not getting into the harmless error.
Yes, sir.
I'm getting into the question of trying to figure out why we can't resolve this case based on the manner it was litigated, in terms of saying there was no plain error, when the defense at trial did not put any of these issues into play.
It absolutely can be resolved at using that analysis.
Your argument was it can't be, you're arguing that it can't be resolved as testimonial hearsay without more facts. That's what you're saying.
That's I understand.
Why isn't this a,
please answer that.
Why isn't this an example of statements made under circumstances that would cause a reasonable witness to believe they could be used at trial?
Again, Your Honor, that has
State police lab, forensic scientist, case-specific, taken from someone during an arrest. The thing comes in a syringe. I don't know if that's a fact, actually, but you can tell me what it is.
Yes, it does, or yes.
So the state police lab technician gets a syringe and says, what's in this syringe? And she says, gee, I don't know whether this is a unit sweep of state police officers or whether this might be something, or whether this might reasonably conclude that this could be used at trial.
Yes, Your Honor, that could very well be the case if the same technician is removing it from the syringe and then inserting it into the machinery that runs the scientific...
Are you arguing chain of custody?
No, Your Honor, I'm arguing that we don't know any of this. And it could be the fact that the same lab technician did that, or all of the samples could have come to the lab technician on petri dishes or whatever.
Now, we know they came in a sealed package containing one metal spoon bearing residue and a small piece of cotton. Here it is. And why isn't that Crawford Category 3?
Yes, Your Honor, and it may be Crawford Category 3 for Ms. Maldonado, the scientist. And she would function the same as Mr. Zarni did in the Magyari case, that she would be explaining those results of the drug test. And this court found in Magyari, as you know, Your Honor, that the lab technicians would not have been making independent determinations. They would have been recording unambiguous factual matter.
That is one element of Magyari.
Yes, Your Honor.
But I'm still asking about Crawford. Why wouldn't Ms. Maldini fall into the category of a person who, under these circumstances, could reasonably believe that what she was concluding would be used at trial?
She could very well fall within that category, Your Honor. It is possible, but again, this court cannot get to that question because the underlying factual basis isn't there.
I'm still confused as to what fact is missing from Ms. Maldini's standpoint.
Yes, sir. If Ms. Maldini was not involved in the investigation or knew nothing of that previously and is just interpreting what that report means or laying the foundation for that as a business record.
But are you stipulating that we don't know whether Ms. Maldini is like the scientist or lab technician in Magyari, that she might have had 250 of these bags with the same stuff in it and not known which was there for trial and which was there for some other reason?
That's possible, Your Honor.
Okay.
You can make that conclusion you can ask that question on this record.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. We cannot make that assertion or that conclusion.
No, I didn't say that. I'm saying that, in your opinion, this record is ambiguous enough to where she might have had 250 of them.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Go ahead. I mean, I think that you have a problem with prosecution's exhibits 1 and 2, which are called certificate of analysis, that list the appellant here as a suspect and are signed by Ms. Maldini with the certification that she's undertaken the requisite tests, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, how can you make a straight-faced argument that we can't tell that she knew what this was for?
That she
thought that she was looking at this evidence for anything other than a criminal investigation into suspect Josh Harpo.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That may be a difficulty with Ms. Malvini. The same way I believe it may have been a difficulty with Mr. Zarna in the Magliari case, that he was a quality assurance officer. It's unclear whether Magliari would have come out with the same outcome absent his testimony.
It seems that your argument is that there might be somebody else who was involved in the testing process.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, but, so then I get back to Judge Ryan's question. Maldini certifies that I performed the above analysis or examination. Seems to me she's saying she did it, and this is what it resulted in.
Look at the very bottom.
And if we can't take that at its face value, then this should not have been admitted in the first place.
It should not have been.
I mean, if we can't take that certification to mean what it says, then there is a question as to whether it ever should have been admitted.
Yep. Your Honor, it is very possible that taking that, taking all of the other considerations out of Magliari, that it may be the fact that this was prepared in anticipation of litigation, therefore rendering a testimonial.
Okay, so if in fact she certified to it and she prepared it in anticipation of litigation, criminal litigation, is it the government's position that would then be testimonial?
Yes, Your Honor. I imagine that would qualify as testimonial under those circumstances. But again, those are circumstances that we just can't know.
You think it needs further analysis or further fact-finding?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Because there could, in fact, have been more other people involved in the testing. Although, that's...
Seemingly unlikely, but maybe. I mean, I think your argument is a little unlikely, but you're arguing that there could have been other people involved.
The same way there were in Magliari, along that chain of custody, there are a number of people, I believe 20 in Magliari, who touched the wound surface.
Well, is it your position that if she prepared this certificate of analysis in anticipation of litigation, that it's a business record or not?
Yes, it could very well be a business record, Your Honor.
Let's stipulate that she wrote on the bottom, I'm heading towards a legal question, that she wrote on the bottom, I prepared this in anticipation of trial, and let there be no doubt. It's just testimonial, okay? Why is this or is this not plain error, plain and obvious error?
Specifically,
not your facts, the fake facts I just gave you.
I think even under that factual scenario, Your Honor, it's still not plain error because of United States v. Williamson, an Army CCA case that 65 MJ 706, where the Army CCA comes out to the opposite opinion of the Navy and Marine Corps.
Wait, so we're bound by the Army Court in some manner?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, but that shows what the trial...
My question wasn't what did the Army Court do. My question was, why wouldn't my scenario equate to plain error?
Specifically because of the situation that the military judge at trial was faced with. And that is specifically that...
So even though we now know he was applying the wrong law in my scenario... Applying the wrong law, the wrong constitutional law, we don't apply that retroactively?
Yes, Your Honor, under your factual scenario, that would always be, if there was a certificate stating that I've produced this in anticipation of litigation.
Even if the defendant didn't object and preferred to have the certificate to the live testimony, which gets back to the question that I started out with asking appellant's counsel, which is, does Crawford require...
I'm sorry, can I just pocket...
Sure.
That's a fair point, but I don't want to add the additional fact in there. two scenarios. One, there's an objection. Two, there's no objection. Plain error in my fake scenario.
Well, in face of an objection? Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, he objects on some grounds other than Crawford, right? Because Crawford doesn't exist yet.
On confrontation, on the confrontation clause. It was in existence at the time.
Well, it was offered as a business record, so he objects on business record.
Right.
Okay. He doesn't object. You've already indicated we're in a plain error scenario.
Yes, Your Honor.
So why is the objection determinative of the plain error? If you've indicated we're in a plain error scenario, you're now trying to get rid of the plain error by saying he didn't object. But that's a circle.
We always end up at plain error with objection
okay.
or no objection.
Under my scenario, why isn't it obvious error? Supreme Court said Category 3. The person just certified this is Category 3. Why isn't that plain? My scenario, not yours.
Yeah, under your scenario, absolutely.
Okay.
The objection at trial is irrelevant.
Well, okay. Counsel, let me try it another way. No fake facts. Facts that we have here in this case. But an assumption. Assume that we conclude that under the facts of this case, it's testimonial because there's sufficient facts to show that this lab examiner knew what was going on, knew she was going to testify in trial, etc. And assume that we apply it retroactively. What's the plain error analysis then? And that is the plain error analysis then the question of whether we apply it retroactively, or is the plain error analysis one of which, and this is perhaps where Judge Ryan's question leads us, was the military judge required to think anything about Ohio against Roberts or Crawford anticipating that or anything? And that is, was there an error in the judge letting this in at trial even if there was a potential Crawford objection on the part of counsel? And that goes to the question that was asked for the defense to address. Where in the law is the military judge required to inquire of the defense when hearsay evidence that has a potential confrontation issue is going to come into evidence?
Yes, Your Honor, I'll answer that question in two ways. One, the military judge, under this court's precedent, would have to do an analysis that would withstand plain error. Because
what does that mean? I don't understand what that means.
I believe, Your Honor, your earlier question was about waiver. Could this have been waived if it was a tactical decision by trial defense?
Yeah, my question.
No, that wasn't the Chief Judge's question.
Yeah, my question is if the prosecution stands up and offers some evidence that he has a hearsay component to it, where in the law is the obligation on the part, and there's no objection on the part of defense, there's no inquiry, there's nothing. Where in the law is there an obligation upon the military judge to analyze that hearsay, assess whether there's a confrontation issue, and then inquire as to the defense as to whether they would waive it? That problem existed prior to Crawford. Ohio against Roberts was still a confrontation law test. It was a different test, but there was still the confrontation. And was there any obligation under the Ohio against Roberts regime that a judge, either in military or civilian life, go through an analysis of every piece of hearsay to determine whether it had a confrontation clause component to it, and then personally inquire of either counsel or the defendant as to whether they objected to the hearsay coming in?
Even though they'd said no objection?
There absolutely is not a requirement for that.
Well, if there's not, where's the plain error in this case? Assuming that Crawford's retroactive, assuming that Crawford would allow an objection here, if there's no requirement that there be an inquiry on the part of the judge, why would there be plain error here?
There is not plain error in this case, Your Honor.
I'll ask you the same thing I asked the appellant. What is your estimation of the state of the law on this question now?
I would give the same statement that appellant gave, Your Honor. It is not settled. I can't tell you to a numerical certainty the number of states and various circuits that have come out on each side of the issue.
Would you say it's in flux?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Do you think that the state of the law is in flux based on the jurisprudence of this court with respect to the answer about whether this type of evidence would be testimonial, non-testimonial? I understand the state of the law in general is in flux, but I think that you indicated when Judge Baker gave you the scenario that it said, you know, that this was prepared in anticipation of litigation, that you agreed that that would be testimonial. Is that under the law of this particular court?
Your Honor, if you're asking me if opinions of this court have caused some of the state of flux of the law?
No, I'm asking you a slightly different question. Is based on the opinions of this court with respect to analyzing Crawford and applying it to different types of evidence, do you think that there's a real question as to whether this particular type of evidence is testimonial or non-testimonial, irrespective of how it might come out in any other court in the country?
No, it is not, first, but it may be in the way that you can see the lower court applying it. From a plain reading of Maggiore, it is not unclear how the analysis is to be done, but the lower court did not.
They just jumped to the conclusion that it was not.
Yes, Your Honor, to the wrong conclusion that a lab report is per se a business record, therefore not testimonial. That's
you.
Clearly not the test, Your Honor.
Thank you for your candor.
In this case, first of all, the government's position is that there was no plain error, therefore, these laboratory reports coming into evidence were not error. Secondarily, even assuming error, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Third, if this court seeks to either further clarify or issue an opinion as to the testimonial nature of these statements, it's the government's position that this case needs to be remanded for further fact-finding before this case can do so. If there are no further questions, the government rests.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the defense.
Thank you. First of all, the case of Maggiore, the facts are completely distinguishable than facts here. Ms. Maldini, the state forensic broker, bears no resemblance to the 20 or so technicians in the Maggiore case. In Maggiore, the 20 technicians did not equate specific samples tested with particular individuals or outcomes, nor did they test any of those samples in furtherance of a particular individual law enforcement investigation. In this particular instance, we have the exact opposite. We have Ms. Maldini, who is a state employee. She received the items that she tested were tested after they were seized from the appellant. The appellant was listed as a suspect on her laboratory reports. She is a forensic scientist. That's what she does. She testifies in trial. She knew the exact purpose for what these reports were going to be prepared for. This, there could be no doubt. Also in Maggiore, this court indicated which direction we were going to go in regards to how we're going to analyze laboratory documents. You made a specific point to indicate that you rejected the government's evidence that laboratory reports business records are per se non-testimonial. You mentioned that in certain circumstances they could be testimonial. You mentioned that if the primary purpose of the preparer was to prepare statements in anticipation with the eye toward prosecution, future prosecution, then that could be testimonial. You also mentioned that the preparer was involved in a law enforcement function. These are all circumstances. All the circumstances you mentioned in Magali, all the circumstances you mentioned in Rankin, all the circumstances you mentioned in Forrester, I believe I may.
Counsel, if I may interrupt.
Yes, sir.
Assuming, without signaling where we're going,
yes, sir,
that Crawford would apply to the precise circumstances of this case, and that upon objection, the evidence should have been excluded. What case stands for the proposition that either under Crawford or Roberts, the judge has a sua sponte duty to inquire of the defense or the defendant or both as to whether there's an objection to a business record or any other form of hearsay which is offered by the opposing party?
I have no cites. There's no case.
Okay, thank you,
sir.
Then why would it have been plain error for the judge not to make that inquiry in this case?
I believe the answer lies in the very reason why the Supreme Court allowed for retroactive application of their mandates. In every such case, when you have retroactive application of a Supreme Court decision that changes the state of law as we know it, you're always going to be able to say, well, there's no plan A because he didn't know that this was going to come out. That is true. The question I believe this appellate believes is not whether or not the military judge made a mistake in the rulings that he made. He did not. But in light of Crawford, it is plain error now. And the appellate contends that this court, there's good public policy reason for this court to take that stand because it is so plain and so obvious in light of Crawford, in light of this court's pronouncements in Magali, that there was plain error here.
But I don't think that really answers the Chief Judge's question. I think he's not asking about what the rule should be if there had been a ruling by the military judge. If, for example, the defendant had objected and the military judge had overruled the objection and allowed the evidence in, I think that what the Chief Judge is saying is, given the fact that you can identify no case that says that he has a sua sponte obligation to say, well, defense, when you say no objection, do you really mean it? Then if in the absence of a case that says that, why would we find plain error? Why would we find error at all?
We find error at all because of the fact that this particular laboratory document did not qualify as a business record. The appellant is not contending that the military judge made a mistake in light of Roberts, in light of the appellant's counsel at the time's failure to make an objection. All the parties' decisions there can be understood in the context that Crawford was not there at the time. The appellant's counsel did not make an objection because there was no Crawford. And under Roberts, you know, based on the basis that the Confrontation Clause is essentially a evidentiary rule designed to ensure reliability of hearsay statements, why would we object? This is a certified document from the state lab. The appearance is reliable. Under Roberts, he had no basis to insist that it was unreliable. So he did not object. The judge, seeing no objection, there's no sua sponte reason for him to get in there and say that. We're not contesting that. What we're contesting is in the light of Crawford. That Crawford identifies the evil at which these types of ex parte testimony, what the evil of the ex parte testimony can wreck in a defendant. Crawford tells us that the government should not be able to use ex parte testimony against an appellant.
If tomorrow the trial and the lab report is brought in and it has a special certification at the bottom saying that this is testimonial, and the defendant does not object, is that a Crawford violation?
Yes, I would believe so. If the defendant does not object, then it would be subjected to the plain error analysis. And yes, it would be in addition to maybe ineffective assistance of counsel. But I would believe that in that particular instance, we're talking about a fundamental constitutional right that there would be good reason to insist that the military judge, sua sponte, make some sort of inquiry into whether or not that appellant is making a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary relinquishment of his fundamental right to confront witnesses against him.
Can I ask one question? You mentioned ineffective assistance at counsel, and I guess my question with respect to that is, let's say that the government, instead of putting a young child, the allegation is that the child has been raped, and for whatever reason decides to put in a written statement from this 8-year-old or 10-year-old that basically just in black and white sets forth some facts. And the defendant doesn't object and the defense counsel doesn't object because they would rather have those black and white words on the paper than a 10-year-old child crying on the stand. How would that be an effective assistance of counsel?
It wouldn't necessarily be, of course, and I don't want to get, in your scenario, if the counsel who made that decision made an affidavit after the appellate counsel made that allegation and provided that explanation, of course there would not be because he would have sufficient reason. There'd be tactics there. On his face, without knowing that, it might very well be, but there might be a reason for that.
Okay, so you're not arguing that failure to object to otherwise testimonial hearsay would be per se an effective assistance of counsel?
No, I'm not saying that. There could be tactical reasons for making that decision.
Are you not arguing? Let me be clear, you're not arguing that the person can't waive a constitutional right, but that the judge is required to make sure that's what they're doing.
In some cases, yes, sir. I'm definitely saying that.
What does it mean, in some cases, you're definitely saying that?
Yes, I am saying that, sir. There needs to be some indication in the record that there's a knowing voluntary relinquishment of that right.
Counsel, sounds to me like you're saying in every case in which hearsay is admitted, where there's a non-testifying, where the witness isn't present, the hearsay declarant isn't present, the judge has to make an inquiry. Is that your position?
In every case where there's a fundamental constitutional right involved, that's my position, sir.
I understand. Thank you.
You're saying constitutional hearsay, not hearsay per se.
Hearsay.
Depending on how you parse that out.
I agree with that statement. Okay. Yes, sir.
Further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
We thank both parties for the presentation today. That concludes our arguments for this week, and the court will be adjourned.